You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Summertime in Florida. Tourists flock to the subtropical paradise for its beautiful beaches, abundant sunshine, and the magical allure of Disney World. For one Midwestern mother and her two teenage daughters, a trip to the Sunshine State seemed like a dream vacation. But the promise of a sunset cruise by a friendly stranger turned that dream into a deadly nightmare. This is the true story of that tragic encounter and the hunt for the Sunset Killer, a modern-day American monster. The book we're featuring this evening is American Monster, The Search for the Sunset Killer, with my special guest, journalist and author and attorney, J.T. Hunter. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, J.T. Hunter.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be back here again talking with you.
Thank you so much for this. Congratulations on this new book. Incredible. Let's go to, as you do, right in the very beginning of your book, in your prologue, we go to Tamarack, Florida, and police find a woman nude on the street, or someone finds a woman nude on the street, positioned. She's identified as Evelise Bergeris, a student at Broward Community College. What is the condition of the body and some of the circumstances that they find this woman that day?
Yeah, so this was in 1990. This is a few days after Thanksgiving, November 27th, 1990. A couple guys that had been out in their weekly bowling league were driving back home in a residential neighborhood. You know, it's kind of a typical middle-class neighborhood. And as they made a turn at night here, their headlights illuminated something laying in the road up ahead of them. And when they got a little bit closer, they saw that it was a woman, and she was laying in the street. They stopped, jumped out of the car, went over, got closer, and she looked to not be alive anymore. And the body looked as if it had been positioned there on purpose, such that rather than, you know, just kind of haphazardly being tossed out of a car or something, the body had been propped so that it was in kind of a doggy style position with the head down and the buttocks up. Appeared to have some abrasions and some markings indicating that, you know, foul play had occurred for sure.
What did authorities find out about Evie Bergeris and where she was working and details of how she met her fate?
Well, Evie, she was known as Evie to her friends. She had been working her normal job at the Sawgrass Mills Mall, which was in the nearby city of Sunrise, Florida. And she had, as usual, closed the store that she worked at and apparently had walked out to the mall parking lot with one of her coworkers, as it is, again, was kind of her typical routine. And when she got to the parking lot there at the mall, she saw that her car's tires had been slashed. Two of the tires on her car had been slashed. So both the tires were flat, so, you know, she was stuck there. And by this time, her coworker had walked off to her own car and had left, so Evie was there by herself. And at some point shortly thereafter, she was taken from the parking lot by an unknown person, And that was the night of November 26th. You know, it was probably about 10:30, almost 11 o'clock at night at that point. And then her body was discovered the next night.
Mm-hmm. And police also found that there was another attempt at that same parking lot, but that woman had called her husband and her husband had picked her up, but an intentional flattening of the tires in that parking lot, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. There had been the same sort of situation had occurred to another young woman's vehicle as well. And that woman was similar to Evie in age and body type and those sort of characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you say at the time, you write that there was no suspect DNA at that time. They did a reenactment on television, but there was no real response. Everybody's just summed it up. What a tragic loss. What an angelic woman, angelic girl. You go to the next, in the book right away, you introduce the Sunshine State, and you talk about the three major cities of Tampa, Clearwater, and St. Petersburg, and it being the second largest metro area in Florida, has a lot of water, over 400 square miles of water. And we go to June 4th, 1989, and three bodies are found by three different boaters. Tell us the condition of the bodies and what the Coast Guard finds out after these boaters tell them about these bodies. What's the condition? What do they find?
So about 6 or 7 months before the incident with Evie and Sunrise, as you said, in June of 89, there were some boaters out in Tampa Bay there, in the Tampa Bay area, and on this particular day, they came across some gruesome discoveries. Three bodies ended up being found in the bay. The first one was found about 9 o'clock in the morning, 9:30 in the morning. A boater was coming back from a trip, and he saw something in the water floating ahead, and as he got closer to it, he saw that it was a human body floating face down in the water. He, of course, called for help, and the Coast Guard was dispatched to the site, and they ended up pulling a very decomposed, bloated body from the water. It was a white female, about 100 pounds, and she was nude from the waist down. She just had a t-shirt on, basically, and her hands were bound with rope, anchor type rope, and her ankles were also bound as well, and she had some pieces of gray duct tape on her chin, apparently having been gagged with the duct tape and having slid down during the decomposition process. And the Coast Guard officer that found this individual described it as really being a really gruesome thing to see. He described the horrible look on her face that she had, that was frozen there in death, indicative that she had this really terrifying experience.
Yes.
And shortly after that first body was found, not even maybe half an hour later, another boater came across another body at a different part of the bay, a couple miles away. And this was another female, same sort of condition, bloated, decomposed, hands and ankles bound with this rope material. And again, duct tape as well. And a significant thing about these two bodies as well was that they had been tied to what turned out to be these concrete blocks, like these home construction CVS kind of cinder blocks. They had been tied to these blocks to weigh them down. they didn't discover that with the first body because the block weighing the first body down was stuck underwater somehow. They couldn't get it dislodged no matter how hard they tried. So they ended up having to just cut the rope. And later attempts to try to find that that block were unsuccessful as well by divers. But with the second body, they did in fact have the concrete block attached to the rope when they retrieved the body. They were able to bring that up. So that was a common characteristic as well. So that was the two bodies, and then half an hour later or less from the second body, a third body was reported. And, again, the Coast Guard was dispatched to the scene, and same sort of situation. Another female, another white female, another bloated, decomposed body, hands and ankles bound, gagged, concrete block, everything the same as well. So really, a really, really gruesome discovery of these three bloated bodies floating out here in Tampa Bay on an otherwise really nice summer day.
You write that because that they're in the water, any hair, fibers, fingerprints, semen, or any other trace evidence is washed away. And so the effort to identify victims, they have a press conference, they display the jewelry found, and then they have the medical examiner do the autopsy. What's his result? And then what can they tell and what can't they tell about what happened before or after death concerning these three bodies, three people, pardon me?
Well, exactly, as you said, because the bodies have been in the water for so long, the water, the motion of the water had washed away any sort of, forensic evidence that typically might be found at a crime scene. So it made it, a much more difficult case from the get-go for the police as far as that goes. And the medical examiner, found the cause of death the same for each of these three victims, asphyxia for all three of them. And, of course, drowning is a form of that, but mm-hmm. the bodies have been in the water for such a long period of time, which the medical examiner estimated they had been in the water 2 to 3 days before they were found. It couldn't be determined definitively that drowning was the actual cause of death versus strangulation as the cause of death. So that sort of circumstances of how they died kind of had to be pieced together a little bit later on as the investigation went forward.
In the investigation that moves forward, 4 days after the bodies found, you write that there's the first lead. This is June 8th. A maid at a Days Inn noticed the bed's not slept in for about a week and nothing used like the towels. And she had read about the three bodies in the newspaper and told her manager. So from that, what do police determine about these bodies, these people found?
Yeah, so several days after the bodies were found, the police really didn't have anything to go on. They still had these unidentified bodies, Jane 1, Jane 2, Jane Doe 3. No leads at all, had no idea who these people were. But then several days later on the 8th of June, a maid, as you said, at a hotel at a Days Inn off of the Courtney Campbell Causeway there in the Tampa Bay area, noticed that this one particular room at the hotel there didn't seem like it had been used for quite some time. The people that had taken the room had checked in, obviously. Their belongings were there in the room, but the beds didn't appear to have been used, the whole time the subsequent few days, and the room appearance hadn't really changed in those days as well. So finally, at this point, this particular maid who had read something in the newspaper about the bodies being found, three bodies being found, as you mentioned, got suspicious, rightfully so, and reported it to the general manager of the hotel there, who checked out the room himself and then notified the police. And the police were showed up to the scene, obviously, and came to the room there and checked it out, and they were able to determine, obviously, from the hotel registry who the room had been rented out to, and it turned out it was rented out to a mother and her two teenage daughters from Ohio. And their names were Joan Rogers was the mother. She was 36 years old. And her teenage daughters, Michelle, who was 17, and Christy Rogers, who was 14 at the time. So these three women had taken the room, had checked in. There was all sorts of, their suitcases were in the room. There all their other belongings were in there as well. Camera film was in there, both undeveloped film, camera film was in there, both used and unused film. Which a little bit later the police developed the film that they found in there, and that kind of helped with the investigation as well. But certainly being able to identify who the victims were was, a big moment in the investigation, because prior to this, the police really had no idea who these people were. So this finally gave them their first break in the case.
You talk about this family, the Rogers family, and they're from a little place called Wilshire, Ohio, and they lived on a small farm. You say the population was 500. And Joanne, as they called her, but Joan's husband was Hal Rogers. And tell us about this trip, because this was a big deal for this family, and Hal was scheduled to go, but he couldn't. Tell us about this dream vacation for this little family.
Yeah, as you said, the Rogers family, they were from this really small, very rural area in Ohio there. And, I could really get a feel for it because, growing up, I used to go up every summer, basically. I used to go up to my grandparents' house in a very rural area of Missouri. And, again, a very, very small town, very similar. So I could really get a sense of what it would have been like for this family, growing up there. But they were from this area. Everybody knows everybody by name, that sort of thing. They didn't really travel much. In fact, the girls had never been out of state on a trip before, on a vacation before ever. So this was really a big deal, for them to be making this trip. And, of all the places they could have gone to, they decided, to go down to Florida, for a lot of reasons, including, the amusement parks, Disney World, of course, is a big draw. That sort of thing. So they planned this vacation, it was really meant to be kind of an escape for them, especially for Michelle. She had some problems there. The preceding couple of years, she had suffered sexual abuse at the hands of her uncle, who actually lived on the same farm as them. He had started abusing her, sexually abusing her when she was 15, and it had continued, over a period of a year or two. So this vacation, a big part of it was to get her away from that whole scene, of having to deal with that traumatic experience, having to deal with the police, talking to them afterwards, all that sort of thing. So they planned this vacation. As you said, the father, Hal Rogers, wasn't able to go. He had to stay back and take care of the farm that they had there. They had various crops planted that needed to be tended to. They were behind on that because of the rains and things that particular year. And then also they had, they had dairy cattle there as well. So they someone had to be there to take care of those as well. So he stayed behind, but he didn't want to, be a party pooper and ruin the vacation, so to speak. So he encouraged his wife and daughters to go ahead and go on the trip and have fun. So they left, it was planned to be, a good over a week vacation they had lined up, and They left on May 26th, is when they left Ohio. They drove down and, you know, stopped at various places on the way, went to, you know, went to Jacksonville, went to the zoo there, went to Silver Springs, went on, you know, the famous glass bottom boat ride at Silver Springs, went to Kennedy Space Center, saw all that stuff, and then made their way to Orlando and stayed in Orlando for several days. You know, went to SeaWorld, went to Magic Kingdom, went to Epcot Center, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, towards the end of the trip, they made their way over to the Bay Area. And that's when they got over there. They drove over to the Bay Area on June 1st, which was about a week into their vacation at this point.
Mm-hmm. Now back to Hal Rogers, and he finds out about, on the same day that he expects his family back, he finds out from police that they're dead and they've been murdered. And June 13th, there's a funeral. And you had mentioned that John Rogers had lived on the property, had been co-owner of the farm and lived on the trailer and had abused and raped Michelle for 18 months or over a two-year period several times. And so he had bought, Hal had bought his brother out of the property, and his brother had traveled to Florida on a vacation prior to Hal Rogers' family traveling. So there's some, tell us about the funeral and just some of the observations that they find about Hal Rogers.
Well, yeah, the funeral, you know, it was attended by a lot of family, a lot of friends, you know, showed up for it. There was, you know, about 300 people showed up for this funeral in mid-June. You know, at the church there in the area, you know, kind of this Gothic style church. And, you know, of course, there was a lot of sadness, a lot of emotion, a lot of Michelle and Christy's friends were crying throughout, and you know, as you would expect. You know, Hal didn't show a lot of emotion. You know, based on everything I found out about him, he tended to kind of keep his emotions inside, didn't really show his emotion much, and you know, that kind of came across to some people as odd, you know, that he wasn't reacting like, you know, they thought maybe a father who had just lost his wife and only two children should be reacting. And it, you know, just struck them as strange. So, you know, there were some suspicions arose from that, like, well, you know, did Hal have anything to do with his family's murder? Right, you know, is he somehow involved with this, especially because of what happened with Michelle and his brother,
sure.
Who had, you know, who we already talked about had raped her for a while there. And, you know, Hal had actually posted the bail for his brother to get him out on the rape charge, which was also very, very strange. You know, he later explained his reasoning for doing it, but certainly, you know, it would seem odd that a father would post the bail of the rapist of his daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that only, you know, kind of fed this kind of suspicion that was arising, you know, surrounding Hal, and you know, did he or did he not have something to do with the murder of his family?
Now, you say that the investigators, despite their procedures, by September, the St. Petersburg Police Department disband their task force investigating the case. Well, they take 24 detectives to two detectives. But in October, you say, something happens in this case regarding it, Detective James Cappell. Tell us what happens, what he sees, what he realizes.
Yeah, so this particular detective, he had just been reviewing this publication that's, you know, it's a monthly publication put out by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, FDLE, and he was just reading through there, and he came across a notice about a rape that had occurred in Madeira Beach, which is, you know, it's pretty close. It's about 12 miles away from the Bay Area, the Tampa Bay area. And he read about this particular rape that had happened on May 15th of that year, of 1989. So, you know, we're talking about just a couple weeks before the three bodies were found floating out there in the water. And so he read about this rape, and it had supposedly occurred on a boat out on the water. And, you know, that really piqued his interest. And so what he did is he ended up traveling up to Canada to interview the victim from that particular rape. The rape victim had been a young woman visiting the Tampa Bay area there from Canada. And so he flew up there to meet with her and to discuss with her what had happened and, you know, got all the facts of the case. And, you know, as it turned out, a lot of these facts really really raised some red flags as far as, you know, the three bodies that were found a few months later.
You talk about some of these facts. Jan Bradley had a friend, Becky Matthews, and her mother-in-law, you write, they came to Madeira Beach and stayed at a condo owned by Jan's aunt and uncle. And so this is Mother's Day, dinner at the condo, and then after Jan and Becky went to meet some friends at John's Pass, a boat dock area with restaurants and shops, not too far away from the condo. And apparently they went to a 7-Eleven and met a real friendly guy. What were the details in terms of the offer by this friendly guy and the circumstances that only Jan ended up on this boat?
Yeah, so they, you know, they were at this 7-Eleven convenience store that they stopped in, and as they came out in the parking lot, this guy, you know, called out to them, and he introduced himself. He said his name was Dave Posner. You know, he looked to be in his early 30s, you know, had a tan, kind of a little pot belly, a mustache, this kind of strawberry blondish hair. And he came across as this really personable, friendly guy. And somehow or another, the fact that these two young women were from Canada came up. And so he started telling them about how he had lived in upstate New York, you know, which is pretty close to Canada. You know, they had a pleasant little chat there for a few minutes. And then, you know, they said they had to get going to meet their friends. And this guy, Dave Posner, said, "Hey, you know, I can take you over there. It's fine. I'm going that way anyway." And, you know, convinced them to grab a ride with him. And, you know, on the way over there, he kept chatting with them. And, you know, he mentioned he had a boat. And he, you know, said, "Hey, you guys should come out on the boat with me. You know, it'd be a lot of fun. You know, it's great sunsets, you know, this sort of thing." So he invited them out, you know, basically on kind of like a sunset cruise. And, you know, they, Jan eventually, you know, said, "Okay, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do it." And, they arranged to go out on the boat with this guy. But then Becky decided that she didn't want to go anymore. Jan basically said, "Well, you know, we already arranged it. I can't, you know, tell him no. He's already planning it. So I'm going to go ahead and go anyway." So she ended up going out on the boat with this Dave guy by herself. And he took her out on the water, and they had a really, really good time. You know, kind of did it, played like a little tour guide for her, showing her sights and things. And but then at some point after, you know, an hour or two out there on the boat, he had some kind of problem with the engine and said he had to go back to shore for a while to fix it. So he took her back and dropped her back off where he picked her up and said, "Hey, you know, meet me back here in a couple hours. And hey, make sure you bring Becky back with you this time. And then we'll all go out again." So, you know, sure enough, they met back up again. But Becky still didn't want to go, so Jan went by herself again. You know, by this point, she was feeling more comfortable with the guy because, you know, she'd been around him. He'd been out there and, you know, still seemed very nice and pleasant and, you know, certainly not threatening in any sort of way. So she met him again and went back out on the boat with him. And they went back out and, you know, were having a good time again. And then, you know, and then eventually things changed. You know, they saw this like beautiful sunset, just as he said it would be. But, you know, after the sun went down, this Dave Posner character changed.
Yes. You say that, he comes on to her real strong and tells her he's going to have sex with her or she's going to have sex with him. And he tells her, is it really worth losing your life over? And so what does he do eventually regarding this woman after his sexual assault?
Yeah, so he does rape her out on the boat there. And then he takes her back essentially where he picked her up at and, you know, comes up with kind of tells her that, you know, I know you're going to report me to the police, but, you know, do me a favor and wait a little bit, you know, cause I need to, you know, mentally prepare my old mother who's, you know, fragile and she's not going to take this news very well and this sort of thing. So, you know, basically trying to evoke some sort of sympathy, I guess. He drops her back off where she was and lets her go. And, you know, as she steps off the boat, he says something like, oh, you know, watch your step, you know, which is kind of an odd thing to say too, as well, just after you, you know, brutally rape somebody out here, you know, threatening their life. And then you go drop them off and say something like that. But, so then he let her go and, you know, It kind of turned out later on that she was really fortunate in a way in that, you know, she had a friend who had met Dave also and had seen him and knew that they were going out on the boat together and these sorts of things because, you know, this Dave guy knew that there was somebody had seen him, seen his face, and, you know, he couldn't maybe do what he otherwise might have done. Had nobody else known that Jan was out there with him.
Mm-hmm. Now, police have a description, and they create a composite drawing. November 3rd, press release with the sketch. He's described as 5'9", 190 to 200 pounds, short reddish blonde hair, mustache, tan complexion, a 17-foot boat, fiberglass power boat, and had gray duct tape and several ropes on board. And you say the phone calls came in.
Yeah, they you know, the police released the sketch, and then, you know, they started getting phone calls and various leads and started chasing after those and spending time investigating them. And, you know, some more promising than others is, you know, typical case in an investigation. But you know, nothing that really seemed to be getting them any closer to actually figuring out who this person was or, you know, being able to identify them or catch them for sure. You know, they did seek the assistance of the FBI, and they met with the FBI, the Tampa investigators went up to, the FBI's headquarters and, met with them and were able to get a profile of the killer of the three, you know, women whose bodies were found. They were able to get a criminal profile made of the person who did this, and they actually released some of that information to the public as well in the hopes that that would help with the investigation too. You know, the profile found that this was something that had been planned by this killer, that the victims were most likely strangers, and that, you know, control had been a big element of the crime that had been really important to the perpetrator. He had, you know, maintained control throughout the situation, had used restraints on the victims, had very likely committed sexual assault on them prior to killing them, and had obviously tried to dispose of the bodies to conceal the crime, which, you know, turned out to be an unsuccessful attempt. I guess he hadn't accounted for what happens in the decomposition process, but for that, the bodies may well have never been discovered, and no one would have ever known what happened to these Rogers women.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity, JT, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Best Fiends. It was a typical night. Lisa and I had dinner, talked a little bit about her work, then suddenly I disappeared. But no worries, I was just spending some quality time playing Best Fiends. You may have people wondering about your sudden disappearances, but I totally understand if you enjoy playing as much as I do. What I like the most about Best Fiends is it's totally distracting. I'm completely immersed, and I lose myself in playing every time. I just pick up and play a few levels anytime I have a few minutes. It feels great to beat another level or get in the zone. Right now, it's hard to believe, but I'm almost at level 1,000 and only thousands to go. Best Fiends is a free-to-download mobile puzzle game featuring always new adventures and challenges and thousands of levels. With dozens of unique fiends to collect, you customize a team of your fiends to defeat the menacing slugs. Power up your favorite fiends to new levels and watch as they transform and get stronger. You can even play offline if your internet connection is lost. New events and challenges pop up all year. There's chances to earn exclusive in-game items, characters, and rewards. Download your new favorite getaway, Best Fiends, for free today on the App Store or Google Play. You'll even get $5 worth of in-game rewards when you reach level 5. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Now, JT, you said that they had brought in the FBI for a psychological profile, and they were examining other cases that seemed to have similar characteristics to this particular murder of these three women. But you, a character that emerges be very important, emerges early on, and her name is Joanne Steffi, and she had seen that initial description that I talked about, the composite that was done November 3rd, and she saw the sketch on TV and noticed the resemblance of the man that lived two doors down from her. She saw some of the same things that were covered in that report. What did she do with this information, this Joanne Steffi?
Yeah, so Joanne Steffi, she had seen the composite sketch that had been produced based on the input from Jan Bradley and her friend. And when Joanne saw it, you know, it kind of struck her that this sketch looked very similar to her former neighbor, a guy that had lived next to her for a period of time in this residential neighborhood that she lived in, there in the Bay Area. So it struck her that there was this, you know, pretty close resemblance, but she mentioned it to some of her friends and neighbors there, and you know, was basically given the caution that, well, you know, before you say anything about something like that, you know, you need to make sure you're absolutely 100% sure, because, you know, that can ruin a guy's life. You know, if you go and try to say, oh, you know, this is my neighbor here, though, that you have in the sketch, and then it turns out, you know, he's innocent. So she was reluctant, a little reluctant to say anything, you know, because she didn't want to do that, ruin some guy's life. But she did, you know, she kept the sketch. She actually, you know, stuck it on her refrigerator door, and then, you know, kind of put it out of her mind and went about her life. But as the investigation continued, you know, they got a couple years into the investigation, and the investigators made a decision that they were going to release photos of the three Rogers women, of Joan, Michelle, and Christy, and blow them up really big and put them on billboards, you know, off the off the road in the Tampa Bay area there, in the hopes that someone would see them and, you know, be able to provide some more information and give them some, you know, some new leads, because that, you know, at this point they were basically, you know, they're basically stuck. They weren't really making any progress in the case at this point. Just kind of spinning their wheels by now.
Mm-hmm.
So they did that. They released the pictures on the billboards. This was in the summer of 92. So this, you know, we're 3 years into the investigation at this point, you know, and, they released the photos on the billboards. And again, you know, some leads are generated from that, but, you know, nothing, again, really too substantive. But then a couple of months later, there's a decision made to go even beyond that and release some actual evidence recovered from the scene and put it on billboards. And this is, you know, this is a pretty unusual step. You know, for one, police don't typically release that sort of information in an ongoing investigation, you know, because they're worried that doing that is going to somehow adversely impact the investigation. They want to keep certain facts to themselves that only, you know, the killer would know. They don't want it out there, you know, in the public domain, so to speak. So they did this, and what they did is what had been recovered, one of the things that had been recovered was a brochure, you know, like a tourist brochure, advertising some attractions there in the St. Petersburg area. And on this particular brochure, there was handwriting, and there was some handwritten directions, it seemed like, on this brochure. And the handwriting wasn't that of any of the three Rogers women. And, you know, it was suspected that whoever wrote those directions on there, you know, they either had something to do with their murder, or at the very least, they, you know, might have some information that could, you know, really help out with the investigation. So what they did is the police, you know, blew up these directions, this brochure, and displayed that on these billboards. You know, real prominent areas, and so that people could see it. And, you know, of course, pictures of these billboards were then put in the newspaper with a story about it and shown on the news and all that sort of thing. And as a result of that, Joanne Steffi saw that. You know, I believe she read it in the paper the next morning, saw pictures of the directions that had been posted and things like that. And when she saw the handwriting, again, it was something that really seemed very familiar to her. Just as the sketch, the composite sketch seemed very familiar, now the handwriting seemed very familiar to her. So she went to her friend who had who she thought might have some handwriting samples pertinent to this, and sure enough, she did. So they were able to compare some handwriting that they had from this individual, again, this former neighbor, against the handwriting samples displayed there on the billboards. And sure enough, very, very, very similar. And at this point, she was, you know, convinced enough to actually notify the police about it.
Yes, it was interesting. You write that it was a work order for something he had done for the woman. And right away, when police canvassed and talked to the people, the consensus is he was a really nice, helpful guy. And his name was Oba Chandler.
Yeah, and, you know, everybody they talked to seemed to have the same sort of perception of him as you said, as this, you know, kind of nice guy, this helpful guy. You know, he had helped his neighbors with certain things and certain times, and which was actually consistent with what the criminal profile had, you know, predicted, that he would be this guy that would be blending in to the community, that he would seem like kind of a typical friendly, you know, next door neighbor kind of person. And that's apparently that's indeed how he came across. That he was, you know, able to maintain this ruse and blend in the whole time, and you know, no one suspecting anything bad about him at all.
So they do a search, but they have him. His name is, and he has a driver's license for this, is James Wright. But regardless, they have him with a search of his home. You say they find $250,000 worth of jewelry and tools, videos, SMBD, and a green shirt that Jan Bradley said he had on when he raped her. And they find out more about the robbery from his wife, Deborah. Tell us what police find and what they hear about some of his activities with his wife regarding absences from the home.
Yeah, so they were able to eventually, once they identified him as Oba Chandler, they were able to, you know, now that they had this information, they were able to dig into his past and interview his wife and things like this. You know, they did find out that he had committed a bunch of robberies in his past. He actually had a very extensive record of various thefts and robberies, including, you know, the substantial jewelry robbery that had happened in the Bay Area and some other things. But he had a lengthy past, you know, including, you know, home invasion robbery in Daytona Beach area. He had been involved in some sort of counterfeiting scheme, had been arrested back in the early 80s for counterfeiting, served, you know, a lengthy prison sentence for that. You know, again, as you mentioned, he had this alias James Wright, and that's what he had gone by for years and years, and was able to. You know, it really kind of struck me when I was looking into this. One of the things that it just seemed like he was able to evade detection, like just by such a simple means as using this false name and false driver's license. And it really struck me, like, how was that never able to be, you know, seen through? Or how was he able to pull it off by that? Like, how would the police not be able to find out his true identity? But nevertheless, he was able to do this, and so he had this extensive record, and you know, once they did identify him, you know, by then he had left the area, so they had to try to track him down, figure out where he was. They finally caught up to him, finally arrested him. You know, were able to interview his wife, as you mentioned, and you know, learned that you know, he did have a kind of a history of abruptly leaving at times, not really telling her why or how long he'd be gone and that sort of thing. You know, and then, you know, coming back eventually, but so he certainly had this kind of track record of unexplained absences.
There's a grand jury indictment, and he's eventually charged. There was some information. He has a daughter named Crystal Mays, and police find out that there is some contact, and he says some things to his daughter. This trial is unique in that normally you would see a two prosecutor team, maybe an investigator as well. But in this regard, you write that there's four prosecutors on this case, isn't it?
Yeah, the state attorney's office, you know, they really handled this as a extremely important case. You know, it had been the investigation had taken so long, and it was a famous case, an infamous case. You know, you don't find three bodies in the bay very often. So it was it had got a lot of press attention, and so the state attorney's office took it real seriously, and they devoted a lot of resources to prosecuting the case. You know, the trial itself ended up being followed very closely by the media, obviously, as well, and it ended up being a very eventful trial, too.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these commercials. Now, you talked about that they had this prosecution team against this Rogers, but they also had a fine defense team as well, including an attorney named Zinobar. And he had a strategy for this regarding the Madeira rape case and evidence that would be raised at this murder trial. So it's a little complex, but tell us what this legal strategy was.
Yeah, so the lead defense attorney, Fred Zinnerberg, he had originally was fighting having anything brought into the trial about the Madeira Beach rape. He wanted that excluded. He actually, fought quite hard to have that excluded for quite some time. But then when the trial actually started, he abruptly abandoned that strategy and decided that, rather than try to fight that, you would just say, yeah, this rape happened, and, basically admitting that, his client had committed this rape. But the legal strategy essentially boiled down to that it was a different case, and it wasn't sufficiently similar to be able to be pointed to as saying, oh, this can establish guilt of murder, and the thought process being that, well, if the jury knows that Oba Chandler is going to be serving some sort of time for this rape, then perhaps they won't be as inclined to want to find him guilty in the murder trial. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the legal strategy that he was using.
The other part of, I don't know if it's strategy, but the defense attorney, Zinnerbar, had it promised that Rogers would testify on his own behalf, and he certainly did. So whether it was the main issue or one of the big issues was his handwriting match from the directions he gave the Rogers family on the brochure, but also the effect of his testimony at this trial. As you write, tell us a little bit about testimony, what he said, and its effect.
Yeah, so the defense made the decision that Oba Chandler would testify. Of course, in a criminal trial, the defendant does not have to testify. They don't have to take the stand. And quite frequently, in fact, as you probably know, these defendants don't take the stand.
That's right.
Just because, there's a lot of risk involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
Including being subject to cross-examination by the prosecution if you do that. So oftentimes they don't take the stand, but in this case, Oba Chandler took the stand. He did testify. And, I guess the belief was that, he had been able to fool people for so long, and, he had this personality that they figured he'd come across well as a witness, and that, the jury would believe him, in saying that he had nothing to do with it and that he never took him out on the boat and all this kind of thing. But it actually kind of blew up in their face because the jurors didn't really find, one, they didn't find him persuasive, and two, they didn't really like him when he testified. He came across as someone who was, not being honest and someone who was not someone that could be believed and someone that they didn't really like. So it really kind of blew up in their face. And, one of the issues that came up in his testimony was, what happened when he was out on his boat on this particular night, because they were able to place him as being out on the bay the night that the murders would have occurred. They were able mm-hmm. to place him out there based on phone records that they subpoenaed and were able to track down, showing that he had been out there and made calls from his boat on that particular night. So he had to admit, that he was out there. And, so the question came up, well, what were you doing out there and why were you out there for so long and all this kind of stuff? And so his explanation was that he had had mechanical issues with his boat out there, and that he'd basically kind of been stuck out there for a long period of time while he was trying to deal with the, you know, the engine issues that were going on out there with the boat. And, he basically got trapped in a lie. And, you know, it came across very clearly to the jury when it happened. And it was a big, almost like a Perry Mason kind of moment, you know, when the prosecution was able to show that what he was claiming could not have in fact happened as he claimed it did.
Yes, it's very interesting, as you write, very exciting, that at the same time that he's testifying about this repair, ironically, with duct tape, there's an assistant state attorney watching the proceedings in the very courthouse and knew all about boats and immediately knew that why the story sounded false, just not possible mechanically. And like you say, at trial, then it just, this whole thing that he thought was so clever blew up in his face as a lie, as you say.
Yeah, and it really surprised his attorney as well, because basically the attorney basically bought the story as well. You know, he basically
really
believed what the client was telling him, and you know, so he was. This is a big unexpected turn of events when this, as you said, this other member of the prosecution team was watching it, and he happened to be familiar with boats, knew a lot about them, and you know, knew that this probably wasn't true. And so they dashed out and got an expert witness to come in and testify about it.
It's interesting too when you say in the closing arguments, and when the prosecution scoffs at the defensive point that trying to give some semblance of a good character in Oba Chandler, in that during one of his assaults on the boat where the woman narrowly escaped because her friend was waiting for her, he tried to, because she was menstruating, he tried to sexually assault her anally, and she told him that she had rectal cancer, and so he didn't. So the defense remarkably brought that up as some kind of character point for Oba Chandler in this trial. Very, very interesting, and that was scoffed at by prosecution, as you write.
Yeah, kind of a crazy thing to bring up, as you say there. It's, you know, they're trying to show, oh, well, he's not that bad because, you know, he didn't actually anally rape her. You know, he, like, as if he had some sort of, compassion or something, and he wasn't that bad of a guy for not raping her that way. He raped her another way instead, you know, as if any sort of rape would be, you know, okay.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting act to take for sure.
And you write that there was this was 10 days of trial testimony, but the jury deliberated for only 80 minutes. What was the result, and what was the reaction from Oba Chandler?
Yeah, it was a quick deliberation. He was found, you know, guilty of the murders of the Rogers women, all three counts. Chandler didn't have much of a reaction. He was pretty stone-faced for it. And, you know, it took the jury even less time to come up with the recommended penalty for the crime, which ended up being the death penalty. They came to that recommendation very, very quickly. So he was convicted on all three counts in the Rogers murders and given the death sentence.
You write, and we didn't mention this already, but there was some talk of this as well, right from the profiler in the beginning that was brought in from the FBI, that it seemed that there was a possibility that these women were alive when they were thrown in to the water. And the judge made sure that everybody heard that they watched each other die, he mentioned, and he said, imagine the terror. And so it was emphasized what the horror that these women experienced one by one, seeing what was being done to each one of them, and then realizing, and who was last, no one knows, but the horror of seeing each other subsequently be raped and killed and thrown overboard, as they determined, likely alive.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that really, really hit me as well when I was writing this, is just imagining that scenario and imagining being one of these women out there, you know, being a mother or one of the teenage daughters out there on this boat at night and experiencing this and just how horrific that would really be. And the judge really, really brought that home as well in the sentencing. And, you know, I quoted in the book, and, you know, she was really effective in conveying this. And, you know, she said, one victim was first, two watched, imagine the fear. One victim was second, one watched, imagine the horror. Finally, the last victim, who had seen the other two disappear over the side, was lifted up and thrown overboard. Imagine the terror. Chandler's torture of these three women was over, but their panic and fear in the water before their merciful death is unfathomable. And yeah, it really struck me. It was just, I mean, you almost can't imagine how horrible that would be. I mean, just a parent having to witness their child being brutally raped and murdered in this scenario, it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
You know, the thing is that from first responders, from the public that saw the bloated bodies, to the Coast Guard that had to experience the horror of seeing these people unrecognizable completely, to the people in the task force, Sandra Cummings, Detective Moore, J.J. Goyhagen, and the other people that were dedicated, and this case hit them personally, and they were all involved in bringing this guy to justice. But also what we didn't mention was there was very interesting array of inmates that were feted and then were prosecution witnesses. So some of the horrific dialogue that was provided at this trial that people can read about also reinforced from the Madeira rape dialogue to other things that Rogers said to these inmates that reinforced that he was referring to these murders and in his incredibly callous nature and some of the horrific remarks he said apparently about the Rogers murder and what he said to these people before they were killed and other victims that narrowly escaped murder from Rogers itself. So the trial is very eye-opening, and his testimony, that you provide, is harrowing as well. It's an incredible trial, and one of the jurors had mentioned, you wrote that he had a smirk on his face, and that juror just wanted to wipe that smirk off his face.
Yeah, exactly as you said. You know, it really, some of the testimony that came out really underscored the callousness, the cold-bloodedness that he had, and that he, you know, how he carried out these crimes, and, you know, almost, you know, seemed really proud of himself almost for it and kind of bragged about it.
You write that appeals wound through the court slowly. 17 years later, he was up for execution. But what you write was very interesting. We go back to the prologue now in your epilogue that February 25th, 2014, there was a major announcement in a 25-year-old homicide. And when we had mentioned that Evie I'm butchering that name, in November 1990 in Coral Springs, there was improvements in DNA technology. And Chandler had lived 1.5 miles away from the mall where she was last seen. What is that announcement regarding this woman?
Yeah, so this was one of the things that really interested me in the case, too, when I was researching it. You know, that 3 years after Ovid Chandler was executed, he's tied to a new crime, to another murder, you know, thanks to advances in DNA technology. And, you know, we see this happen in other cases as well, obviously, as the technology has improved, the ability to solve various unsolved crimes that has occurred, and that certainly happened here. And you know, he's executed in 2011, and then in 2014, there's an announcement from out of Broward County that that Over Chandler has been identified as the killer of Evelise Vagaries, as you said, that had happened back in 1990. So this unsolved crime, now thanks to the DNA advanced technology, is able to be solved. And what had happened is investigators there in Broward County had, you know, aware of the fact that the technology had gotten better, had decided to go back and take a look at this again. And using this better technology, they were able to identify a DNA profile from some semen that had been still on some swabs taken from the victim's vagina back, you know, decades before. And after entering that DNA profile in the database, you know, a match came back for Over Chandler. So this murder, this long unsolved murder, is finally solved. You know, it really struck me that, you know, that's just a great example of how the policing technology advances have helped, you know, solve these otherwise unsolvable crimes.
Yeah. Yeah, in closing, too, you say that Detective Glenn Moore, which was instrumental in this investigation, he had a satisfaction in knowing that the task force, timely aid by members of the public, succeeded in getting a serial killer permanently off the streets. So some semblance of satisfaction. I want to thank you very much, JT Hunter, for coming on and talking about your latest, American Monster, The Search for the Sunset Killer. I want to thank you very much for this interview, JT Hunter.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on again, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future, I hope.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, JT Hunter. Good night.
All right. Take care.